Hello Terry, this is Dennis Stevens, and today is the 18th of January 1994, and I received your very, very welcome tape this morning, and have decided to get down to replying to you right away. First off, I hope your wife is recovering from the hip replacement surgery that she had. I hope she's recovering from the operation. Please please pass on my get well quick wishes to her, won't you? Well, here we are in the middle of summer in Redland Bay. It's a typical summer's day today. I've just looked at the temperature. I have a little thermometer on the wall. The temperature in this room at the moment is 86 degrees Fahrenheit. And the air has a consistency of a Turkish bath. And so the humidity wouldn't be much less than 86%, probably about 80%, which is not at all unusual for Redland Bay in the middle of January. We have a tropical cyclone, a Class 3 tropical cyclone, Rewa, is about to ground and cross the coast about 300, 350 miles north of us, and that's causing our normal prevailing easterly wind to freshen up a bit, and is also the cyclone is dragging some very humid tropical air down, so it's a little more humid today than it would do. We've got this tropical air being dragged down from the cold sea from the tropics. It will probably be even more sticky tomorrow. It will become more and more under the influence of the cyclone. We won't experience any structural damage or anything down here. They will up in Mackay, but of course they're quite used to it up there in the tropics. Down here we'll just get the increased wind and the higher humidity, and just an accentuation of our normal subtropical summer, I hope. So all in all, I think you'd probably welcome a little bit of our warmth in England at the moment, and certainly here in Redland Bay, we welcome a little bit of your cool air. It's a little bit trying. This January and February is a little bit trying in Redland Bay, it is. Because unless you happen to be in air-conditioned premises, the only suitable attire for this climate in the summer, in January and February, the only suitable attire is a towel. There's nothing else. I've tried everything else. There's nothing else that's suitable. You just wear a towel or nothing at all. And that's it. I have a fan going in this room at the moment, which you may be able to hear as a background onto the tape, that you'll be able to cut it, get rid of it to some degree, because I'll Dolbyize this tape sending it to you, and if you put in the Dolby, you may be able to cut down the sound of the electric fan, which is mostly in the high frequencies, and the Dolby will cut it down. So I can't turn it off, otherwise I shall simply disappear into a grease spot. So the fan will have to stay on while I'm recording in this heat. To keep you up to date with what's happening with TROM at this end regarding affairs in Europe, Tony Phillips, Anthony Phillips in Denmark, asked me to give him an article which for printing purposes in TROM. I told him it would have to be a tape, so he said okay, so I've sent him off a tape which he'll be able to knock into shape for an article. He may send it to you. I believe he's done such things in the past. You being a professional writer, you've done a little professional transcription work for him. But I spoke very slowly on the tape, so he shouldn't have any difficulty. It shouldn't be any difficulty. No one should have any difficulty who knows the material, who would have no difficulty transcribing it onto the written word and then editing it down to size for use in the magazine. It would just be a routine job for a professional writer who knew the data, who knew what I was talking about. The material on the tape is introductory material to TROM. And so forth. It concentrates on the article. I call the article will be called the Creation of TROM, and it goes into some little detail on the actual creation of the subject.
and how I put the subject together and did the research and so forth. So it should, it can be knocked together into a very, very interesting article if somebody cares to do the work on it. It just, the sad thing is that I simply cannot do it myself. If it was at all humanly possible, I would have put it into written words right away, but I simply can't do it. My eyesight simply isn't up to it these days. I'm glad to hear, Terry, of the excellent progress you're making with the preparation of the production of materials of Trom, getting it into a form where it can be distributed out to others. That's excellent. That's really good news. I'm very, very grateful. I'm very, very grateful to you for this, Terry. Very grateful indeed. Yes, I agree with you regarding numbers of that you need to run off. I would say that initially that your figure of 170 on your database would probably be about right. That would be probably about the top level of the the maximum number that you would need. I would say that it will go out to a lot of the old timers and so forth. They would pick it up as routine, and then they would, I'll tell you what they will do, they will read it, and they will then put it to one side and complete their existing action cycles. Now, you've talked about these action cycles, you're right on the ball here, Terry, you know exactly what's going on. They will then say, right, well, I've got to complete these action cycles that I'm already on, and when I've completed this action cycle, I'll have a nibble at Trom. Well, this is fair enough, and I certainly couldn't expect anything different from this. That I certainly wouldn't expect people to just drop what they're doing and start doing Trom. But on the other hand, one should always be very, very careful about these action cycles. I mean, there is the story of this guy right at the beginning of the universe, this character right at the beginning of the physical universe, who was somebody came along to him and offered him a route out of the universe, and he said, oh no, he said, I'm not really interested in that at the moment. He said, I've got this action cycle complete. He says that if I get this one complete, he said, I won't have to do what you suggest. You know, I won't need a route out of the universe. I'm working on completing the action cycle of the physical universe itself, you see. And I'll get that squared around. We'll end the game physical universe, he said, then I'll get down and do what you suggest. Well, of course, that's the last we ever heard of him. The physical universe is still going on. The moral of the story, of course, is that that some action cycles don't ever end. They're not postulated to end. The physical universe was one of them, of course. It was never postulated to have an end. And so be very, very careful when you get onto an action cycle in therapy, that be careful that you're not on an action cycle which has got no postulated end. Freudian analysis, for example, has got no postulated end. It goes on forever. You know, it's got no postulated end. So whatever cycle you're on, be wary of that. But you said that you hope to have ended cycle roundabouts next September. Well, that's fair enough. So it looks as if the one you're on does have a postulated end. So to continue with what I was saying, there will be a little interest from the old-timers. They will put the material on the shelf until they've actually finished their action cycle. Then one or two of them will start nibbling at it. And then you'll start getting reports in that it works, particularly from the higher-toned old-timers. The ones who can duplicate and run a process exactly as it's written, reports will start coming in. Hey, what is this? This works. It does exactly what Dennis Stevens says it does. And then the flood will start. Then you're going to start needing your printer, and even start to get the whole thing printed, because then the word will really go round. But this is going to be sometime in the future, Terry. It won't happen overnight. And I would say 3-6 months before you'll see any movement along that line. I think most people who are likely to ever use Trom, at least initially, the old timers, they're already on, like yourself, they're already on action cycles, which they will complete, and then they will get onto TROM. And of those, a small proportion, initially a small proportion of the higher tone ones will quickly spot that this works. And then the others who nibbled at it and got themselves in a little bit of difficulty and decided that maybe it wasn't quite the thing, then they'll go back to it and find that it works too. And after that, I think we'll see some form of a snowball effect. There's most people they don't like to be out in front, you know, on a thing like this, on a do-it-yourself sort of therapy. They like to get a report in that somebody else has tried it, and not just the guy who wrote it. I think you understand what I'm getting at here. You yourself, for example, supposing you knew that 10 independent Scientologists had tried TROM and all reported that they used it and found it was a very, very good technique, and it did exactly what Dennis Stephen said. Well, you'd be more inclined to use it, wouldn't you? You see that? So everyone sort of waits for everyone else to start using the technology, because everyone's a little bit scared to use it, because everyone's a little bit scared of their reactive bank. You see that? Which is why the early steps of TROM are, of course, to break the sphere of the reactive bank. That's the first thing that has to be done on a self-audit basis, on a do-it-yourself basis, is to break the sphere of the bank. And TROM does that very, very neatly, I can assure you. Getting your tape a little bit out of sequence here. I've got it, put it up on the other recorder, I'm replying to it, but this little bit I want to talk about now is relevant, although it's a little bit out of sequence. You're very aware, like I am, of the difficulty of running, taking money from one country to another without being ripped off by the banking system. In the old days, of course, the banks, before they adopted this system called user pays, which are much beloved by big business and banks and so forth, user pays, which everyone who's thought about user pays knows that it's an upmarket phrase for those who have no money go without. But anyway, the banks are right into user pays, and all these old services that used to be only have a nominal charge or were given free of charge and now charged by the bank to the actual user. In the old days, of course, the bank used to make their profit by the difference between their lending rate and their borrowing rate. And since they've got into user pays, they decided that this is not such a good idea. So now they've, instead of making their profit from the difference between their lending rate and their borrowing rate, they're now trying to make their profit by charging people for their services, which of course is wonderful for the rich, because they've got plenty of money to afford to pay for these services, but it doesn't help the poor man in the slightest, because it costs him, he wants to write out a bank check, it costs him about $8 to produce a bank check to transfer $20 from one part of the world to another, and yet the millionaire probably only gets charged for about $8 or $20 for a bank check to move $1 million from one area of the world to another. So all these things, you see, favour the wealthy, and they don't favour the poor, which is one of the objections to this principle of user pays. But anyway, the easy way out of it, you've given some suggestions there. Go to a travel agency, yes, you could do that. The other way out is simply to, if you want to transfer money to Australia, is to, I can find out in the local bank if they will change English currency. I think they will, but I'm sure Australia does some trade with England still. We still sell England some wool, I'm sure, or something goes from Australia to England, so there will be some backwards and forwards trade between England and Australia, in which case Australia will be able to change English currency through the banks. But I shall make some inquiries on this. It may be cheaper to change the currency than to actually for issued bank checks. I don't know. but I shall make some inquiries and I shall let you know. I've got a feeling that this will be a cheap way to do it. Will be you simply send English currency over and it will be changed. Just the person at this end simply walks into an Australian bank and drops the English currency on the counter, and the bank give the equivalent in Australian currency. I'll check this out and let you know. Otherwise, as you say, there's ways of doing it through travel agents and so forth, doing it in American dollars. American dollars would be very acceptable in Australian banks, I'm sure. There's still a certain amount of reverence for the American dollar in Australia. It's still regarded as a hard currency over here. It's still much harder than our own currency, so it would be very acceptable in an Australian bank, I could assure you. Oh yes, before I forget it, anyone seriously embarking upon the upper levels of TROM, that by the upper levels I mean level 5, level 5A, level 5B, level 5C, they are the upper levels of TROM. If a person wishes to seriously embark upon those, I would suggest that they get the supplementary tapes there which I've cut, which are in Greg Pickering's possession. The reason for this is that it will save them a lot of time and a lot of trouble. There's a tremendous amount of data about this universe and about the mind and so forth which becomes apparent to you as you do level 5 of TROM. It can come up in some of it can come up in a puzzling form, and you start to get worried, thinking about it, worrying about it, and it doesn't always all make sense all at once. And I've been through this hoop of level 5, and I've noted it all down, you see, and then I've put it all together, and these become the supplementary tapes. So you'll find in the supplementary tapes there is a resume of the sort of material that will come up on the subject of the human mind and the subject of this universe that will pop up while you're running level 5, and this is in the supplementary tapes. So they're an addendum. They're a helpful addendum. Also, and this is not to be overlooked, the supplementary tapes do put the subject of TROM on a logical foundation, which is not the write-up as it stands is not sitting on a logical foundation, so it wouldn't appeal very much to a scientist. But once the scientist saw a transcription of the of the supplementary tapes, he would see that this subject is on a logical foundation. So there's two factors there. It can save. First is it can save the supplementary tapes can save the person an awful lot of time in therapy. Because it clarifies lots and lots of material that's going to show up, and so they know what's coming, so they're prepared for it, and it explains it. And the other factor is, of course, this subject of a logical foundation, which for many people is not of particular interest. That's mainly why I didn't put it in the original write-up of TROM. I know it's of a rather specialised interest. It's of vital interest to a scientist, but it's only of marginal interest to the vast majority of people. That the subject matter is on a logical foundation. But nevertheless, that's it. If you want to get the logical foundation of TROM, it's in the supplementary tapes. And again, that logical foundation can help a person with level 5, because that gives them a very great insight into the material that they're working with. So all in all, those supplementary tapes, I recommend that they be used before a person gets stuck into level 5. Levels 1, 2 and 3, the supplementary material is not particularly important, because there's not much of it is going to show up. But once you start to get into level 5, level 4 marginally, but level 5 certainly, a person is well advised before they start seriously getting into level 5 to hear those supplementary tapes. It will speed their progress considerably, I can assure you. Quite a lot of this supplementary material I simply didn't have at the time when I wrote up TROM. I simply didn't have it. I hadn't completed the, remember, I hadn't completed level 5 when I wrote that write-up of TROM. So much of the supplementary material I hadn't got at my fingertips. It was still in note form and hadn't been finalised at the time when I did the write-up of TROM. And the remainder of it, of course, I purposely left out because I didn't want to overburden the reader and make the write-up of TROM too long. I tried to keep it down to, well, I succeeded in keeping it down to 78 pages, which I think is quite a remarkable achievement. Yes, Terry, with pleasure. On this tape, later on this tape, I'll give you a pocket resume of my Scientology career. No trouble at all. Yes, I agree with you that a little 5 or 10 minute promotional talk on the subject of TROM, which you could play at your next conference in May. That too will appear later on this tape, Terry. So you'll get both of what you want on this tape. I'm sorry it's all going to have to be on this tape. But you can, of course, because I'll Dolbyize it, and it'll be on a good quality. I'll put it on a good quality bit of tape for you this time, so you'll be able to copy it quite confidently. You'll be able to copy it. I'm sure you've got facilities to be able to copy it if you want to, so that you can copy it and put it on another bit of tape if you want to. Yes, regarding the butchering of Ron's works by the modern church, I agree with you that it's a regrettable activity. Well, of course, when the bottom line is profit, everything else does really have to go out the window, you know. The original edition of Dianetics, a Modern Science of Mental Health, back in 1950, went well over 400 pages. If I recall, I could be wrong here, but I've got pretty good recalls of this. I think it went something like 435 pages and was about 3 inches thick. That would give you some idea of the size of the book. It was a substantial book. And the one I saw in the Sydney Library was only about a third of that size. It was about a third, so about two-thirds of the book had gone. So I don't know about other books, other early books of Ron's that have been butchered. Maybe Science of Survival has been butchered. Maybe Creation of Human Ability has been butchered. I don't know. I don't know what they're doing down there these days. But I'm pretty sure that of this, Terry, that already I think we can say with some degree of certainty that the best of Scientology now is to be found in the field, and is not to be found in the central organisation, which is a terrible thing to have to say, but nevertheless, I believe that is so. I believe it to be so. Yes, the independent field and the splintering, this is inevitable, and the splintering will continue, and while the field has no cohesion. You see, there's nothing at the moment holding the field together. In the old days, the central org held the field together, but now the field is separated off from the central org. There's nothing to hold the field together. As you say, everyone's doing their own little thing. And this splintering just will go on and on and on until some form of cohesion occurs in the field itself. I hope that TROM will provide that cohesion. But until something comes along which will stick the field back together again, it will continue to splinter. It's a technical problem, Terry. It's not an administrative problem. It's not a promotional problem. It's a technical problem. And the field needs something. Everyone in the field can subscribe to and realise is worth subscribing to in the way of technical material. And once this becomes known and so forth, they will subscribe to it, and the cohesion then will come back to the field. But until this happens, the field will continue to splinter, simply because there's nothing to prevent the splintering process from continuing. We're replaying the last little bit of tape here. I'm beginning to sound like Harry Seldon in the Isaac Asimov's wonderful story, Foundation, series Foundation, Foundation of the Empire, and Second Foundation. You no doubt are a science fiction fan yourself. Do you remember Harry Seldon and his future history? How he used to come on the line and make these predictions. As I was replaying that little bit of tape, I suddenly snapped into my mind the thoughts of Harry Seldon, that Dennis, you're becoming a Harry Seldon. Yes, I do remember the Co-Auditor's Manual. I haven't seen the book. It was a soft cover edition book, if I remember rightly, if my recalls are correct. It was a very, very good book. I read the book, and but I agree that it went out of fashion, didn't it? I wonder why it went out of fashion. Need one ask. Right, Terry, well, I think we'll get down now and get down to these little speciality bits of tape you want. First off, I'll give you the a little 5 or 10 minute tape of promotional material which you can use at your next conference. My name is Dennis Stevens, and this is the 18th of January 1994, and I've been asked to cut this piece of tape by Terry Scott for use at his next conference. About 60 years ago, an American president named Roosevelt announced that what America needed at that time was a good 5-cent cigar. Well, a few years ago, I decided that what this world needed was a good, workable, do-it-yourself psychotherapy. And that psychotherapy now exists and has the name of TROM, which is the acronym for the Resolution of Mind. Now, those of you who know your Dianetics will be saying to yourself, how on earth has Dennis Stevens managed to derive a workable, do-it-yourself psychotherapy, when we all know that the reactive mind cuts the analytical mind out of circuit during therapy. So if a person attempted to take their own reactive bank apart, they would fail because the reactive bank would get re-stimulated and would cut the analytical mind, their analytical mind, out of circuit and bring the auditing to a standstill. So how did Dennis Stevens achieve this remarkable feat? Let me tell you, it didn't happen overnight. I thought about the problem on and off for about 10 or 15 years, this idea of preparing a do-it-yourself psychotherapy. And I always did believe that there was a way round the problem. Then, one day, the penny dropped. Actually, it's very, very simple. You get the analytical mind, or you train the person via the analytical mind to do what the reactive mind does. And that is TROM. That is the first steps of TROM. The reactive bank, the reactive mind, as we all know, those who study Dianetics and Scientology know that, well, first of all, they know that there is such things as engrams, and that there is such things as re-stimulation, there is such things as reactive mind, there is such a thing as this reactive mind re-stimulating and cutting the analytical mind out of circuit. These things are real things. These are true things. These are real things for anyone who's ever studied the subject objectively and subjectively. It's interesting that even knowing this puts you into a far higher category than the average person alive on this planet at this time. The fact that you know it, that you know these things exist and you know these things to be true, the average person doesn't know this, ever. And there's a vast conspiracy afoot to make sure that he never finds out too, but that's another story. So So we have this reactive mind who is stimulating and impinging upon the analytical mind and cutting the analytical mind out of circuit. Essentially, this amounts to the fact that what the reactive mind can do, it can move scenes, incidents, etc., out of the past and bring them into the present. Now that is the basic function of the reactive mind. If it couldn't do that, it would be powerless. It can actually bring things out of the past and bring them into the present. Once I'd spotted that, I was on the road to doing it, because I said to myself, supposing we apply one of Ron Hubbard's well-known principles, that if we get the pre-clear to do consciously that which his mind is doing automatically, then this function will come under his own control. So what if we were to get a person to take things out of his past and bring them into the present, and then take them back out of the present, put them back into the past again, and we were to put this as an exercise, and we were to formalize this as an exercise, isn't this exactly what the reactive mind is doing? And if we got the person to do this consciously, he would be taking over the automaticity of the reactive mind, and the reactive mind would lose its power over him. And this is precisely what happens. I found the technique to do it. You will find these techniques at level 2 and level 3 of TROM. There's a definite practical exercises which will permit you to do this. You are simply taking over the automaticity of your own reactive bank. So you can eventually, you get to the point where you can say to your own reactive, you can just simply cock a snook at your own reactive bank. You can do what it can do. It can restimulate engrams, you can restimulate engrams. So it wants to restimulate an engram, so can you. So you can beat it at its own game. And once you've got to that point, the reactive bank goes quiet. It goes as quiet as a lamb, and it leaves you alone, and it never bothers you anymore afterwards. You achieve that point when you've reached the top of level 3 in TROM. Now, can these techniques be run on you by separate therapists? Oh yes, but they won't achieve any result. Because while you're dependent upon the separate therapist, you'll never be able to cock a snook at your own reactive bank. You must do these steps solo. You've got to do them solo. If you want to crack that bank, you've got to do steps 2 and 3 solo. What about step 1? Oh, that's simply an introductory step. That finds out whether the person is capable of running solo. It's as simple as that. I simply discovered a technique which would find out if a person is up to running solo. Obviously, below a certain case level, the person isn't up to it, and they could damage themselves if they attempted to run solo. So we've got to find this level out. Well, okay, I developed a technique which will do this, and that's level 1. If the person is below, if they do level 1, level 1 indicates that they're not up to running solo, okay. They do a very well-known set of Scientology objective exercises, and when they flatten those objective exercises, they can then go back and do level 1, and they will find that they will now pass level 1, and they're ready to run solo, and they can then go on and complete the job solo. Technically, what level 2 and level 3 of TROM achieve is to break the compulsive games condition that exists between a person and their own reactive bank. It breaks that games condition down until the game ends. The person stops playing games with their own bank. And once they stop playing games with their own bank, of course their bank quietens down and goes away and leaves them alone. Okay, so we have this person who's reached the top of level 3. Well, where do they go from here? Well, they go into level 4 and level 5, which is a general procedure for handling games across the whole of life. They simply go in and take this whole subject of games apart. This is why I call TROM. It's called a games manual. It is a games manual. My God, you learn about games in TROM. You learn all there is to know about games in TROM. You learn so much about games in TROM that you give them up after a while and stop playing them. You realise the sheer futility of them. But before you can do that, you've got to go through level 5. You've got to go through the subject of purposes, goals in conflict, and get this whole subject of games resolved. That is level 5. It's much longer to do this than levels 2 and 3. Levels 2 and 3 happen rather quickly. You can get to the top of level 2 and level 3. For many people, they would simply stop there. But the results are enormously good, but at that stage, they might not want to go on to levels 4 and 5. But for those who want to go on, well, they've got to have to spend some more time at it. But the results are well worthwhile, because you learn all about, in levels 4 and level 5, you learn all about this universe, you learn all about the games, and you learn all about the human psyche, and all about minds. It's all there, all locked up inside your own psyche. It slowly divulges to you as you do level 4 and level 5. Mainly on level 5. Level 4 is simply a preliminary step. It's simply an introductory step to level 5. But level 5 is the key step there. When you finish level 5, where do you go from there? Well, you don't go any place. I don't know of any level 6. I've been looking for level 6 for quite a while now. Every time I find a procedure that looks like a level 6, I find it's a subdivision of level 2, 3, 4, 5. So, I don't know of a level 6. When you finish, got to the top of level 5, and you reckon you've found a level 6, well, you let me know. I'll be pleased to hear from you. But I don't know of a level 6. Alright, now what about case gains? What about case gains from TROM? Well, I can only talking for myself, that by the time I'd reached the top of level 3, every procedure that I knew of in Scientology and Dianetics, those processes, every process and procedure that I knew of in Dianetics and Scientology was flat. Not one of them had any charge on it. Flat. The emotional tone at the top of level 3 was serenity, which I could always return myself to back very, very quickly at any time I wanted to. Now, by the time you finish level 5, and again, I've checked this out on myself, every piece of Scientology technology in the upper levels of AOT levels of Scientology is flat, flat, flat. There's nothing, nothing that I know of in the field of Dianetics and Scientology will do anything for your case. You flattened the lot. You finished. In fact, I know by the time you finish level 5, I don't know of any psychological procedure that would do anything for you. You've done it. You've resolved it. You've resolved mind. The mind is resolved. The goal has been achieved by the time you get to the top of level 5. If it weren't, I wouldn't be giving you this material. I would still be researching it, I can assure you, because I'm a very thorough researcher. One thing you can be sure of, whatever you have when you get to the top of level 5, it is not an aberration. You've erased the lot. Well, that is TROM. And I'm very grateful to Terry Scott for this opportunity to introduce you to the subject. Thank you very much. Hello, Terry. Here we are back again on the 19th of January, the day after. There's a heavy pall of cloud outside. It's raining heavily, and there's not a breath of wind. Every now and again there's a crack of thunder, and the cyclone, which should have crossed the coast by now, 300 miles north of here, the last report is that it parked itself 250 miles off the coast and become stationary. They do this every now and again, these cyclones. They become an absolute menace. They just sit there, and now we're in for days and days of tropical air being dragged down from the Coral Sea and circulating around that cyclone and spraying all over the coast of southern Queensland. It's going to make our weather conditions down here unbearable for the next 4 or 5 days until it goes away. Anyway, these things
are all a part of a Queensland summer. Well, there's the little talk, Terry, for use at your conference. It runs about 12 minutes. It's a shade over the 10-minute maximum, but I decided to leave it at 12 minutes. I don't think I could get it down much below that without seriously interfering with the material. Now, this little talk covers the same material as the article that I sent off to Anthony Phillips. So there's a possibility that if Anthony prints the article, then you may consider that this little talk I've sent you, this little 10 minutes, 12 minutes of promo material, is too similar to what Anthony has printed to be of any use to you. If that is the case, not to worry, just drop me a line and I'll pronto send you another one on a different subject. Okay? So not to worry. One way or another, I do want to get the material that are on both, on the one I sent to Anthony, on this material I've sent to you, one way or another, I want to get this material known. I want to get it out, understood, just what I'm doing with TROM. And more importantly, what differentiates TROM from other practices. Gets around, you won't be able to make a living auditing people for money, I can assure you, because they'll make faster and faster gains on TROM than they could ever make working with a separate therapist. Well, that is the creation of TROM, and I wish you luck with it, and I'm very grateful to my old friend Anthony Phillips for this opportunity to be able to present this material to you. Thank you very much. Anyway, so much for that, Terry. In a way, it's a pity that you and Des Popham were unable to get together, and Des was unable to give an evaluation of TROM. I would have because I was somewhat looking forward to hearing his report. But nevertheless, as I said in my earlier tape, I don't think that he could have given a very good evaluation until he'd actually tested the material out subjectively himself. He would have had to have tried it, in other words, before he could have given anywhere near a valid report on the material. I don't think it's possible for anyone to give a valid report on TROM without having tested it subjectively themselves. They would have to try it. Well, now the next thing you asked me for is a thumbnail sketch of me as a person and my Scientology career, from which you can select bits out for use for promotional material. This will be, in effect, a very condensed version of the 4.5 hours of tape which are already extant in the possession of Greg Pickering, which he asked me to record, of the Scientology reminiscences of myself and Anne. So this will be a condensed version of that, with the stress on me. I was born on the 3rd of February 1927 in Tottenham, an inner suburb of London, England, and I was the only child of two working class parents. My early years were in growing up in that semi-slum area of Tottenham were fairly uneventful, but the personality as I developed showed more and more interest in what might be called introspection, more and more interest in things to do with the mind, more and more interest to do with scientific things, and more and more interest in things artistic rather than things to do with the body, such as sport or travel or things like that. In other words, I was growing up to be what's sometimes loosely called an intellectual. At an early age at school, I showed a fair aptitude, a good aptitude for mathematics and scientific subjects, and of course the English language. I was always very good at the English language. my weakest subjects were foreign languages, simply because I could never see any reason for foreign languages. I just couldn't understand why there was foreign languages. I thought if you had a good language like English, there's no reason why everyone shouldn't speak it. So I was never interested in speaking foreign languages. And so I was never good at foreign languages at school. I'm not a linguist. I'm hopeless at languages. But nevertheless, I do have a good command of my own language. When I got to 11 years of age, my parents moved from the rented premises we were living in Tottenham, and Dad bought a house out in Edgware, which is about 12 miles out in northwest London. And at that time, I passed my scholarships and went off to what was then known as a county school in order to get my matriculation. And eventually it was foreseen that I would go to university and get a degree. That was what was confidently predicted by my parents. And my school teachers, because I was always fairly near the top of the class and showed a good aptitude for maths and science, they agreed that I was good university material. But all this was suddenly thrown into the melting pot when I got to 15 and a half and 16 and developed an enormous desire to play a clarinet and a saxophone in a jazz band. And so I arrived at the age of 17 and a half. I got my matriculation, but I'd squandered my university chances. And so I arrived at the age of 17 and a half, a better than average jazz clarinetist and saxophonist, but a rather a poor prospect for university training as a scientist. My two great artistic expressions in life have always been music and writing. Later on in my life, I did actually write a 300,000 word novel, which I never sent off for publication, but I did actually write it and enjoyed it immensely. So there are my two artistic expressions, are music and writing. So I left school around about 17 and a half, 18, and got myself a job. And my main interest in life at that time, of course, was playing my music. I was out every night of the week virtually playing in dance bands and so forth. I was earning a lot of money. I was earning more money from the dance bands, and I wasn't my day job. As the day job was getting nowhere fast, this didn't bother me. All my interest was in music. And my only other interest was I was an avid reader of science fiction. And also I had, even as a young person, a young man, an adolescent, a considerable interest in psychological matters. So by the time I got to 18 or 19, I'd read all I could lay my hands on of Sigmund Freud and Jung and Adler. I was well versed in psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, and so forth. Everything that was known on the subject, if it was in the local library on the subject, I'd read it for sure. It was my hobby. Was the mind. So that gives you a thumbnail sketch of me around about the age of 18 when I left school. Well, I went on like this until 1950 when I was 23. So the period from 1945, 46, 4 or 5 years there was devoted in almost entirely to playing in dance bands. I became a very accomplished saxophonist. I used to do a lot of very good class work. I couldn't become a professional because my hearing was never quite good enough. You have to have very, very good hearing to become a professional musician. My hearing was never good enough for professional. I was accomplished enough on my instruments to be a professional, but the best I could achieve was top flight semi-professional, which I was. I was a top flight semi-professional jazz musician by the time I was 21. And that was in the period 1945 to 1950. In 1950, I read the article in Astounding Science Fiction. Of course, I was a science fiction fan, and that changed my life. I had at that time I had a subscription to the American Astounding Science Fiction magazine, so an email subscription. So when the first articles came out in May 1950, I think it was, in the Astounding Science Fiction magazine, a week after it was published, the magazine arrived, dropped through my letterbox. So I was right on the ball reading Ron Hubbard's first article in Dianetics in the Science Fiction magazine, the Astounding Science Fiction magazine, and I immediately got in touch with a bookseller to get the book Dianetics air freighted over to me from America. And due to various delays and so forth, none of which were to do with me, all to do with the bookseller and the publishers and so forth, I didn't actually receive the, didn't actually get the book until early August in 1950, when the book arrived. One Saturday I was phoned up by the bookseller and he told me the book had arrived, and I got on my motorbike and I was over there that Saturday and got the book, and spent the whole weekend reading it. And that started me, that was the start of my Dianetics and Scientology career, was August 1950. I was mightily impressed with the book by Ron Hubbard, I was mightily impressed with the whole thing, and I ended up going round trying to get my friends, my old school friends mainly, to try and find a co-auditor. Well, that meant lending the book out to them, and it all delayed time, but eventually an old school friend of mine agreed, and he read the book and thought it was okay. He was nowhere near as enthusiastic as me, but anyway, we got down to doing some co-auditing in September. It had been about first or second week in September that we actually started our co-auditing, and I found out later that that I was the second, well, he would be too, because we were co-auditing, that we were the second people to start auditing in the whole of the UK. We were preceded by George Wishlow in Cricklewood. He was, I met George, and later, and he put his first pre-clearance session in the middle of August 1950. And he did some, years afterwards, he did some research on this, and he couldn't find anyone in the whole of England or anywhere in the UK that had audited prior to August 1950. He reckoned he was the first, and I don't know of anyone who audited prior to that. So I'd say that Georgie Wishlow was the first, and my co-auditor and I, we were the second ones to start actually using Dianetics in the whole of England. By the end of August, and by the end of September and October, of course, there was a lot of auditing going on over in London. By the end of the year, there were dozens and dozens of, lots and lots of people were auditing by then. But those were the beginnings. I wrote off to the New Jersey Elizabeth Foundation that Ron had set up, and they gave me the address of the Northwest London group, which was run by George Wishlow, and I dropped down there and joined the group, and quickly I was, as George, who was a very good group organizer and a very good auditor, George was, but he wasn't all that good technically, and he quickly realized that I was, you know, even in those early days I was showing a flair for the technical side of it. And he used to field the questions of the group over to me, and eventually I became the group, well, within weeks I became the group secretary of the Wishlow group. I was one of those very fortunate people that I had a good auditor. He was, he was an old school friend of mine, you know, he was a well-educated young man, and he could follow instructions as given in the book, and he audited exactly as per Ron said. And he happened to be blessed with a very easy running pre-clear, so that was me, and I got incredible results from that material of Dianetics, from that first book material. Incredible results I got. I started off with a black field, I had no pictures, I had no sonic, very poor impressions, and within a few sessions my Vizio turned on, I had beautiful Technicolor Vizio, but then sonic impressions, and then sonic on the track turned on, and accurate, all the perceptive channels were within 6 months of auditing, all the perceptive channels were running beautifully, were running fine, exactly as Ron said in the book. And it wasn't until I audited my own pre-clear, my co-auditor, when I audited him, he was a much tougher case than I was, and although he made good gains, and he was very happy with the gains he made, they weren't as spectacular as the gains that I was making and that I made under his auditing. We continued the co-auditing team for about a year, and then suddenly one day he upped and said he was going to get married. He'd been meeting this girl, and he decided to get engaged, and it was going to be a quick wedding. He was going to get married. Well, Sigmund Freud once said that when the patient announces that he's going to get married, that is a success of the therapy. And in his case, it was. It was a success of the therapy because most of his difficulties that he had in life were sexual. And when we started therapy, started auditing, he was far too shy to even approach a girl, let alone ask her to marry him. So I'd done a hell of a lot for him, and he knew it. And he thanked me very much, and he went off and got married, and they've lived happily ever after, as far as I know. So he did get an awful lot out of it, but I never thought he got as much out of it as I did. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe he got as much out of it as I did. Anyway, we broke up our co-auditing team, and I had to go and find another co-auditor, which I did, from the group. By this time in London, there was various groups. There was a Central London group. There was a group out in East London with Stanley Richards, who was running that group. I met, of course, hadn't met Stanley, but I'd written to him, phoned him. And there was the South West London group. It was run, the Battersea group, was run by a lady called Anne Walker. Again, I'd written to her and phoned her up. And then in late 1951, I think it was, a guy called Jack Horner turned up and ran a congress in London. And we all got, all these people that we'd known each other over the telephone, we all got, met each other, you know. And I met Anne, and we fell in love and got married. And met Stanley Richards and so forth. And it was a very, very marvellous congress that was in late 1951. But at this time, I was still carrying on my dead-end job in the daytime, spending a couple of evenings a week auditing, and Sunday evenings, of course, were group member night, group night. And then one evening a week, I was as group secretary, I was devoting to my typing letters and keeping up with the group's correspondence. And the rest of the nights of the week, I was out around the dance halls and the palace doing my, earning some money and enjoying myself playing my dance music. So it was I was a very busy boy during that period from 1950 right the way to 1951. Very, very busy I was indeed. And it never let up at all. I was flat out the whole time. I was either auditing, being audited, doing something for the group, or I was out playing a saxophone with 1,000 dancers dancing around in the dance hall, and getting home about 1 o'clock in the morning and dropping into bed and getting up at 7 o'clock, going off to my day job and so on. This would just go on day after day after day. When I'd learnt to play my own musical instruments, I'd sensibly taken some lessons from a very, very, well, one of the best jazz saxophonists in London, one of the best jazz saxophonists in Britain, actually, and he taught me to read accurately and phrase very accurately. And I was making, well, during this period from 48 to around 51, there was a hell of a shortage of good class musicians in London still because of the after effects of the war and so forth. And the promoters quickly realised that here was a young man who could read and phrase spot perfectly in a dance band, and I was in enormous demand there. And I was out every spare time. I was turning jobs down every spare moment I had. I mean, I could have done more work than I was doing. I could have been out every night I wanted to, leading five-piece sax teams in dance halls. It was incredible, you know. It was hard work, but it paid very well, and I enjoyed every moment of it. We then moved through to September 1952, and then the arrival of Ron Hubbard in London. He arrived at our Wishlow group one evening, and we wanted to give a demonstration of auditing, and I was the lucky customer, and he put me into session and turned me into a theatre clear, exteriorised me and did everything. It worked out absolutely marvellously, changed my whole life in just about a 45-minute demonstration session that he gave. And I met the greatest auditor in the world, and Ron was. There was no doubt about it. I've been audited by him. And I've been audited by many people, but there's nobody could audit like the old man. He was the greatest. Anyway, after that, it was a mad whirl. He soon announced that he was going to give an HPA course in London in in September, no, when was it, September, November 1950. It ran about 8 weeks, it did. And it started very soon after he visited the Wishlow group. And I had to make a decision, what do I do? Do I become a professional Scientologist, or do I continue on with my band work and the life I've been leading? Well, I just thought, well, I'll take the plunge. I'm not getting anywhere with my day job, and I can never be a professional musician. So I might as well take the plunge. So I put my money down and did the first HPA course in London in September 1950. That was in September 1952. And did the HPA course that Ron taught in London in 1952. The end of that course, we all got an HPA certificate. Ron had said, if you send in three case histories, he said there's a Harvard graduate auditor certificate waiting for you for any of you that send me in three case histories using the material I've been teaching you on the course. And I thought, well, that's fair enough. So within a couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, I'd grabbed myself some. Well, I had the very clears and audited them and sent in the case histories, and lo and behold, I've got myself an HGA certificate. Now, quite interesting historically, that is probably the rarest certificate in Scientology. I found out later there was only 4 of those certificates ever issued from the 15 people that were on that HPA course that Ron gave in 1950. Only 4 of us sent in the 3 case histories and got the HGA certificate, and mine was number 1. So it's quite a unique one, number 1, and there was only 4 of them that were ever issued. They were never issued for any other course. Ron resurrected the HGA certificate years later as a graduation certificate on the St Hill briefing course, but he'd used it much earlier in 1950. That was its first use of the HGA. So I ended up at the end of the course, within a week or two of the end of the course, with an HPA certificate and an HGA certificate. I was feeling very, very proud about that. Meantime, Anne, she couldn't be on the course. She couldn't afford it, truthfully. And but Ron, she'd been in touch with Ron, and he hired her to look after the Hazzy. He set up a Hazzy in London right at the end of the course, and Anne was the secretary, and she virtually was the association secretary. Anne was the first association secretary of Hazzy London. And I used to come in and about 6 o'clock in the evening to take her home. And then one evening Ron dropped in, bounced into the room. I was waiting, she was typing a letter, and we were going to go off and have a meal and go home to get the children fixed up. And Ron said, looked at me, he said, I want you as director of processing for the organisation. So there I was London's first director of processing. The job mainly consisted of looking after auditing the HPA students, because they'd set up an academy, and a guy called Dennis O'Connell was running it, doing the training, using Ron's tapes, and Ron wanted those students to get some decent auditing, so he selected me to do it, and he said, we're going to set up a clinic, he said, but that's going to be a little bit in the future when we get some money, he said, going to afford some premises for the clinic. So I was the first DFP of London, Hazzy London. Of course, there wasn't enough students on course to keep me employed full time auditing students. So the referrals obviously used to come in to Hazzy for an auditor, and they used to get passed over to me. It was a natural thing for them to be passed over to me as the director of processing. Until such time we had a clinic, I was doing the any referrals came in to Hazzy for an auditor, they would be passed over to me as the director of processing of the organisation. So that was what I was doing, spending my time doing, and doing the auditing. I was full-time, flat-out auditing as a Hazzy staff member, as director of processing. This takes us on through 1953. The next thing of great
moment was in 1954 when Jack Horner reappeared. He'd reappeared back in 1951 and gave a congress, and now he appeared back again in 1954. Ron had been giving some clinical courses in the USA, some doctorate courses, and Horner was one of the star graduates, and he was good. Horner was good. He knew his stuff. And Ron sent him over to England to run a clinical course over in London. So the first London ACC was held in 1954. First and second were held in London by Horner. And I was on that, and so was Anne. We were both on that, and we graduated from that and got our doctorates. When we completed all the course requirements and so forth. And so that took us through to 1954. And by this time I was I've got quite an imposing array of certificates on hand. I've got my HPA certificate, I've got my HGA certificate, and I've got a Bachelor of Scientology certificate, and I've also got my Doctorate of Scientology certificate. So I had quite an imposing array of certificates on hand. I was probably one of the most certificated auditors in London. I don't think I don't know of any that had four. Many had three, but four was unusual. It was the HGA that made it unusual. Because I did actually collect the HGA certificate back in 1952, which the others hadn't bothered to collect. The period then Anne and I were out of the organisation, there was a palace revolution, and there were some changes made, and we went out of the organisation. And then back in 1955, Ron wanted us back in the organisation, and so Anne came in this time as registrar in the clinic, and she also came in as DFP, Director of Processing, in the clinic. And that's the time you would have remembered her, in 1955, when she was raised in DFP in the clinic in Palace Gardens Terrace. At that time, I was I'd moved off the auditing line. Anne had taken over that DFP hat, and I was now DFT. I was in charge of the training in 1955. And I was also in charge of examinations worldwide. And Ron was very concerned at that time about the bad state of examinations all over the world, and he wanted it cleared up. And I was spending a lot of my time drawing up examination papers for various grades of auditing and passing them over to the old man for approval. I was the examiner worldwide and also DFT worldwide. A lot of the administration work from the other orgs was coming through London, because Ron was in London at the time, and so he may be DFT worldwide while he was in London. So I was a very busy boy during that period. I appreciated the change over from the processing to the training side, because it broadened my experience of Scientology considerably. Up to then, I'd only had a very, very broad experience of auditing and DFPing, and now I was adding training and DFTing to my skills. I was broadening out my tech skills considerably, and also examining. I was also broadening out my skills on the subject of examinations and technical requirements and so forth. I was becoming quite an all-round technician by 1955 in the field of Scientology. Anyway, towards the end of 55, there were some more changes made in the org. There's always changes being made in the org. And I think I should mention, point it out at this juncture, because over the years, many people have said that Ron Hubbard was a very poor payer in his organisation. Well, this was simply not true. In the years that when Anne and I worked for Ron in London, we earned very good money working for Ron in the organisation. Ron was not a poor payer. He was a very good payer. He was paying top wages to a staff auditor that came in straight off course, and come in just as do a week staff auditing. He was such a person could earn the same amount of money as they could, as a skilled engineer, say, in a factory. So he was paying a top flight week's wages to a staff auditor. And us executives, we were earning way above that. So it's not true to say that Ron Hubbard was a poor payer. What gave the impression that Ron Hubbard was a poor payer was when he went on to the unit system. This happened prior to the unit system. The unit system didn't come into about 1956, 56, 57. And then, of course, it was a different story. But while Ron was paying salaries, he was a good payer. He certainly was not a miserly payer. So I'd like to squash that rumour, squash that for sure, that he was not a poor payer. He was a very generous payer of salaries, Ron Hubbard. Anyway, there came some changes, and the end point was that Anne and I left the organisation in late 1955 and decided to emigrate to Australia. And we actually left for Australia in 1957. During 1956, we were both field auditing from Battersea. We retained the flat in Battersea, and we were both auditing there from the flat. And in 1957, I'd been in touch with Ron. Jack Parkhouse was the association secretary at this time in London, and I'd got Jack's agreement to do some HPA training in Sydney, Australia. In other words, I've got the rights to train, and I've got that in writing. And so we left for Australia in May 1957. And Anne never did work for the orgs anymore. She never worked for the org in Australia. And when she left the org in 1955 in England, that was the last time she ever worked for Ron. So we got to Australia and met a guy called Marcus Tooley, and who was a very good administrator, but he had a very, very poor tech, and he needed someone like me. And he had a whole host of students, and I needed some students to train as HPA. So we closed terminal with Marcus and I. He provided the students and I provided the training. So I spent the first 6 months or so running a weekend course training, giving the first HPA training in Sydney. This was in late 1957. And then when I come to graduate my students, I got them all trained, I'd examined them and everything. All they needed was a seal of approval to get their certificates. I mean, I had all the rights there to train them and examine them. It was all in writing from Jack Parkhouse. But I mean, I had been examiner worldwide. I mean, I was dreaming up the goddamn examination papers. I was completely qualified to examine my own students. And then when I wrote over to London, Jack Parkhouse had moved out. There's been some changes, more changes in Hazy London, and there was new people in there. There was new policies, and they said, "Sorry, Dennis, we can't certificate your students. They'll have to go down to Melbourne and do the HPA course. They'll have to do their HPA training in Melbourne." There's an org would be set up in Melbourne by this time. Well, of course, I was furious. Of course, this was a betrayal of my trust. I was now stuck with 20 students who I'd promised an HPA certificate to, HPA training. And but nevertheless, their policies were inflexible. And so I wasn't very much I could do about it except apologise to the students. They took it very nicely. They were a good crowd. And I went then to see if I could get some more students and do some more training, but without the rights to train, there wasn't much I could give them. There was a lot I could give them, but I couldn't certificate them. I couldn't validate the material I was giving them. And there was an awful lot of unpleasantness went on at that time. It was very, very silly policies. Very, very silly policies going into place at that time on the subject of training worldwide. And the end point was I went back into practice again. Went back into auditing practice again. And meantime, I've been continuing her auditing all the way along the line. And
went back into practice and also resurrected my music, my love for music again, and got back into the jazz scene in Sydney and joined the music scene in Sydney and began to make my name as a musician in Sydney. So my life filled up again with music and auditing. Then in 1960, late 1960, they opened up Peter Williams, who was running the org down in Melbourne, came up to Sydney and decided to open up a Hazzy in Sydney. And I strolled in there one day and felt an urge to get back into harness again and rejoin staff. And George Allen, who was the association secretary, he couldn't believe his good fortune that he'd landed such a well-known, well and capable Scientologist in his organisation. He quickly put me in charge of the academy and the training. And I did the training in Sydney, was DFT in Sydney, all right the way through 1960, 1961, and right the way through to, in 1962. In 1962, Ron started the briefing course by then, and wanted me on the briefing course. So I went over to the UK and did the briefing course. Then George did the briefing course, George Allen, and while he was away, he put me in charge of Hazzy Sydney. In fact, I was holding the association secretary hat and the HCO secretary hat for Sydney. That broadened out my administrative experience. I learned how to run an org. George was away for nearly a year. I was not only running the org as association secretary for a year, but I was also running the HCO sec post as well. There were two senior exec hats I was running for the org. Anyway, eventually George came back, and I went back. He came back and picked up his association sec hat again. We got somebody else in to do the HCO post, and I went back into the academy. Went back to my old hat, doing the training. And the org in Sydney at this period went through a rather lean time financially, and for a spell I had to leave the organisation. The pay just dropped below survival level, and I had to get out in order to live. But I went back again and picked up my old hat again in 1964. Picked up my old training hats again. Then they brought in the new organisation board, and they needed someone in qualification. So they decided that they were also going to run a foundation an evening and weekend. So they said, well, they got Peter Sparshot was going to do. He was a recent graduate from the briefing course, and he was going to take over day qual. And so I took over the evening and weekend qual for the foundation. And that was the last job I did for Hazzy, for the organisation. By this time, the ethics policies had come in and were getting heavier and heavier and heavier. And the conditions were getting worse and worse and worse there on staff. And eventually, we simply parted company. I could no longer work under those circumstances. And so I quit, and so that was the end of the association I had with the organisation. But behind the quitting was the heavy ethics. I simply couldn't. I agreed wholeheartedly with Jack Horner. Jack Horner. Somebody once asked Jack Horner what he thought of Hazzy Scientology organisations. He said, "I love their tech." He said, "But I'm scared to hell. Their ethics scare me to hell," and I felt exactly the same way. I love the tech, but my God, those heavy ethics scare me to hell too. I didn't like them one little bit. Anyway, the end point was that in 1966, I think it was 65, 66, around about that summer. Yes, it was in the summer period that I quit. Very early in 66, I parted company from the org for the last time in Hazzy Sydney, and I never worked for the org again. I then went back into private practice when I could get some pre-clears, and when I couldn't get pre-clears I got myself a day job, but most of my interest was in my music. I was back on the heavily into the music scene. I was out many evenings a week playing jazz on my clarinet, and I became quite a well-known jazz clarinetist in Sydney during that period. And then the urge to write came upon me, and I wrote a 300,000 word novel. That took me a couple of years. I enjoyed every moment of it, and never did get it published. I wasn't interested in getting it published. I wanted to just write it for the sheer joy of writing it. I had a lot of fun with that, and so I am quite an accomplished writer, quite accomplished. There's nothing like writing a 300,000 word novel to make you into a good writer, I can assure you, as you would know yourself as a professional, that there's only one way to become a good writer, and that is to write. It would be around about this time, 1966, 1967, 68, that the ethics in Hazzy got heavier and heavier, and everyone was getting, all the old timers in Sydney and the old time Scientologists in Sydney were getting declared sort of suppressives, and sooner or later we, Anne and I, got declared too. I've forgotten the grounds upon which we got declared, you know. I think we were breathing too regularly. I think that was the trouble, we were breathing. It was something silly like that. And we both got declared, and that didn't mean anything to us. And life just sort of jogged on. Yes, life just jogged on. And I suppose the next most important thing, that Anne was continuing her auditing practice. She's continued her auditing practice all down the years, quite continuously, quite regardless of what I was doing. She's just continued her auditing practice. And then the next thing of note is that I got this urge to seriously began to get down to the idea of a do-it-yourself psychotherapy. And I realised that if the planet was ever going to get cleared, it could only be get cleared on a do-it-yourself basis. That was the only way it was ever going to happen in the final instance. So I set myself the monumental task of figuring out how to do it. And well, as they say, the rest you know. I did crack the problem, and the answer is in your hands. It's TROM, and that is really the culmination of my professional career, is that is in that work there. And it does exactly what it's supposed to do, and I'm very, very proud of it. And if people use TROM, and if they get half the case gains out of TROM that I got out of TROM, then my professional life won't have been wasted. My all the work I put into doing that research, and it won't have been wasted. And I'll be a very, very happy person if they can get just half the cash gains I got out of it. So there we are, Terry. That brings us into present time. So I hope this material is of value to you. Right, this is the end of the personal thumbnail sketch of the life of and professional life of Dennis Stevens, and it also will be the end of this tape, because I see I'm getting to the end of it. So I bid you farewell, and hope to hear from you soon. I hope this material will be of use to you, Terry. Ta-ra for now.